So we'll begin chapter 9. Most confidential knowledge, Raja Vidya. So in the last chapter 8, attaining the Supreme, Krishna was describing two kinds of devotion, Mishra and Kevala Bhakti. So in text 14, he defined what is Kevala Bhakti or Shuddha Bhakti or Ananya Bhakti, pure devotion. And he described that there is other persons, yogis, who are leaving this world in the usual Vedic sense as karma yogis, jnana yogis. But the devotee, he receives all of the results of these other yoga systems automatically, and not only that, but he surpasses them. Acheti tat sarvam idam viritva. And he comes to the Supreme Bodh. So now Krishna describes how to become such ananya bhakta in chapter 9. The type of devotee who surpasses all of the other processes of yoga. So Krishna begins to explain how to become that pure devotee, Ananya Bhakta, in chapter 9. And in chapter 9, he explains his opulences. This is called Aishwarya Gyan. So this Aishwarya Gyan is needed to worship him, to become pure devotee, Ananya Bhakta. So Krishna gives that knowledge by which one can come to Kevala Bhakti. So the Aishwarya Gyan, the knowledge given in chapter 9, is needed to come to Kevala Bhakti. That's why Krishna gives it. So that's the purpose of the particularly the second section from text 4 to text 11. So devotional service or pure devotion is better than karma and jnana. As we said, bhakti is of two kinds, Mishra and Kevala. The Kevala bhakti is very, very powerful. And it's just like the current of the Ganga pouring down from the mountains and just wiping away everything in its path. A very strong current coming from the mountains. It sweeps aside everything that stands in its way. So similarly, Kevala Bhakti is like this. It's very, very powerful. And it doesn't require anything else to bring the results of purification and love of God. And it needs nothing else to purify the heart. But to come to Kevala Bhakti, one must know Krishna. Therefore, Krishna now speaks his opulences in this chapter 9.
Okay, we'll
begin to recite the verses. Shri Bhagavan Vacha Idam Tu Te Kuyattamam Prabhakshame Anasuyave Jnanam Vijnana Sahitam Yajgyatva Mokshase Shubhat. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence." So Krishna says, idam tu te guhyatamam, that I'm going to pravakshame anasuyave, I'm going to describe this most confidential knowledge to you. And in the Bhagavad Gita so far, we've seen there's three levels of knowledge. The knowledge which was given in text chapter 2 and 3 is called guhya gyan, or confidential knowledge. That's useful for moksha and transcending the body, understanding the difference between the body and the soul. chapter 2 and 3. And then Krishna gives knowledge which is Guryatara, which is more confidential, in chapter 7 and 8, because there he's describing Bhagavat Tattva, and he's beginning to describe Bhakti Tattva. So that is the science of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the science of devotional service. And that's useful for attaining the Lord. So therefore it's considered to be more confidential, Guyatara. And the knowledge in chapter 9 is called Guyatamam, or Guyatama. So I have Guya, Guyatara, and Guyatama. So this is the highest knowledge. So in this chapter, anytime we see the word jnana or vidya, it's not describing the kind of knowledge which was in the first six chapters. That knowledge was sattva-gun jnan. But this knowledge is nirgun, because it's describing directly how to come to Krishna, how to develop love for Krishna. So this knowledge is of a higher category. This vidya, that's why it's called Raja Vidya Yoga. Well, this is the Bhagavad Tattva is just beginning there in chapter 7, and there he's describing mainly Mishra Bhakti. And there was just a definition of pure devotion in chapter 8. But here is how to become an Ananya Bhakta. It's just focusing on Kevala Bhakti. It's not just Bhagavat Tattva, it's something more. The knowledge in the first six chapters is of the mode of goodness. And then this knowledge is transcendental. Divya Gyan. Or Prema Gyan, Bhakti Gyan, huh? Well, in the commentaries, I'm just presenting what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has said. So he didn't describe all of the chapters. I would say probably a lot of it is the first kind, Guya. But when there's knowledge about the Lord, then it's Bhagavat Tattva, then it could be considered Guyatara. So probably there's some mixture of these in the various chapters. Yeah, we'll get to that. There's a description of lower rungs of people who worship. Krishna's just making some comparisons in order to glorify Keval Bhakti, to show how high it is, basically. You see that the Lord is calling Arjuna Anusuyave, or he's saying that you are non-envious, right? So this Kevala Bhakti is for those who are non-envious, right? So the Bhagavatam also says the same thing, isn't it? What is that? Yeah. And so it's not for others, this knowledge. It's only for those who are free from envy. And Krishna is telling Arjuna that, so I can reveal this most confidential knowledge about myself to you, because when I do, you will not find fault in me. Because you are Anusuyave. And then therefore I can reveal my heart and everything to you. Prabhupada mentions Anusuyave in the last paragraph, that he says this is very significant. He says, generally commentators, even if they're very scholarly, they're envious of Krishna. So even though They may be erudite scholars. They write their commentaries incorrectly, or very inaccurately, he writes, because they're envious of Krishna. Their commentaries are useless, he says. So one has to actually be a devotee and love Krishna, because there's those only two things. There's hate or envy and love. So one has to be situated in love of Krishna in order to actually understand Krishna and to explain what Krishna means when he says different words in Bhagavad Gita. Ashubhat. So one becomes free from bondage in the material world, and one becomes free from obstacles to bhakti. These are the things which are inauspicious. So, as we said, jnana means bhakti here. So this jnana vijnana sahitam. So Krishna is revealing this secret knowledge. So it means knowledge which is of bhakti, and also vijnana sahitam, which means direct realization of Krishna. Prabhupada comments in the second paragraph, the devotees are constantly engaged in the Supreme Lord's service. The Lord understands the mentality and sincerity of a particular living entity who is engaged in Krishna consciousness and gives him the intelligence to understand the science of Krishna in the association of devotees. Discussion of Krishna is very potent, and if a fortunate person has such association and tries to assimilate the knowledge, then he will surely make advancement towards spiritual realization. Lord Krishna, in order to encourage Arjuna to higher and higher elevation in his potent service, describes in this ninth chapter matters more confidential than any has already disclosed. And Prabhupada also describes this basic description from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. The very beginning of the Gita, the first chapter, is more or less an introduction to the rest of the book. And in the second and third chapters, the spiritual knowledge described is called confidential. Topics discussed in 7 and 8 chapters are specifically related to devotional service, and because they bring enlightenment in Krishna consciousness, they are called more confidential. But the matters which are described in the 9th chapter deal with unalloyed pure devotion. Therefore, this is called the most confidential. Prabhupada, going down to the last or the next paragraph, he says, this verse has specific significance. The words idam jnanam, this knowledge, refers to pure devotional service, which consists of 9 different activities. So, that's how he begins the chapter. Burijan, in his Surrender to Me, says that this verse makes 3 points. That one advances by knowledge through hearing. That one should be non-envious to hear properly. And that one becomes free from material miseries when he hears properly and cultivates devotional practice. So one advances by knowledge, and one must hear. One must be non-envious to hear. And then one becomes free from miseries when he hears properly. Okay, so now we'll read verse 2. This first section is 3 verses from 1 to 3. I didn't bring my... Can you get my notebook? I thought that I had a notebook because I needed the chapter section. So. And in this section, Krishna is just glorifying the knowledge which he will give in this chapter. So it's like an introduction to the chapter. Text number 2. Rajvidya rajaguyam pavitram idam uttamam pravakshavagamam dharmyam susukham kartam avyayam. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed. So these the English translation sounds quite simple, but it's very deep. Because once you go deep into the philosophy, then when you read the translation, then you can see that Prabhupada chose particular words for particular reasons. And maybe we'll describe that a little bit here. So Rajavidya means the king of education. So as bhakti is king of all the processes of yoga, similarly this knowledge is king. So vidya means worship of the Lord in pure devotion. And that, therefore, it is very confidential. Just as the king keeps his treasury hidden from the general mass of people, so Krishna has kept this confidential knowledge hidden in the middle of the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is the essence of all the knowledge in the Upanishads, and in the Bhagavad Gita, the middle chapters are the most essential, or the essence. And of the middle six chapters, chapters 9 and 10 are the middle of the middle. So therefore it's called Rajaguhyam also. It's the most secret knowledge. So Rajavidya also has another meaning. Baladeva Dibhushan says that it means the knowledge of royalty, or royal people, those who are generous in heart. They mercifully work for others' benefits, for the benefit of others. So only they are qualified for this knowledge. This knowledge doesn't come to the miserly, or those who have, you know, miserly hearts. But the person must be have like a royal heart, generous heart, open-hearted. Must be generous. Not miserly like the Karmis who worship the demigods with desire to get sons or other material benefits. So that's another meaning of Rajavidya. So Krishna's glorifying this knowledge mainly by saying pavitram and uttamam, that it's the highest and it's the purest. And Prabhupada quotes in his commentary the verse from the Padma Purana, aparabdam palam papam kutam bijam palam mukam kramen naiva prilieta vishnu bhakti ratatama. So Baladeva Dibhushan says that bhakti is pavitram, that it's very purifying, and it very quickly purifies all the gross and subtle sins of the devotees. Quickly, and in that order given in the verse, that aparabdham first, then kuta, bija, and parabdha. Palanmukham is the same as parabdha karma, that which is manifested. So that's the last thing that is worked on. So bhakti purifies this, all the layers of sin, or all the stages of sin, from the devotee. Generally, it's understood that the parabdha karma, that's the most difficult, because it's what you already have. You know, your kind of mentality and your nature, your, you know, even your bodily features, right? I mean, you can't change the fact that you were born in Maharashtra or whatever, or in America, or whatever. But even the physical features of the person can change when he comes to bhakti, to a certain degree. Just like when Prabhupada's disciples were seen by people in America, they asked Prabhupada, "What country are your disciples from?" And Prabhupada said, "They're Americans." And they said, "No, it couldn't be. They're so bright and so cheery." And he said, "No, they're American. They're from America. They're your own countrymen." But people found it very difficult to accept that, because they actually look different, look more innocent and bright and pure. And, you know, because people in America, they have a certain, you know, look, especially in the city, you know, kind of. certain envious look, suspicious, you know. Gray face, you know, dull, right? Eating meat, some envy there in the eyes. Actually, that's why people can, in the West, sometimes devotees go on sankirtan and they wear street clothes. But the people can tell. They say, "You're one of those Hare Krishnas, aren't you?" Because they can see bright eyes and clean skin, and you know, and the people don't look like that. Normal people, or whatever you can call normal, you know, karmic people, they don't look like that. They look very dull, and you know, the devotee has the kind of, you know, light bulb, if you know, a look to his face or effulgence. You know, it's like, I remember when I had just joined the temple in New York. Well, actually, it was after some years revisiting the temple. I was living in the ashram. I think it was around 79 or 80, and there was one man that was visiting the temple, and he came to me, he asked me confidentially, "Hey, tell me, you know, what kind of soap do you guys use?" You know? And I said, "We just all have our own soaps. We don't, it's not that we have Hare Krishna soap or anything. We all just use all different kinds." He says, "Come on, tell me, what kind of soap do you use, you know?" I said, "Well, why do you say that?" He says, "Because your faces are so bright, and your complexions are so fulgent looking, and so." And I said, "No, we just use regular soap. Come on, you know." He says, "Come on, tell me." He kept like this, you know. It was so funny. I just, you know, in his, from their eyes, they can see a quite a difference. You know, I mean, because we're living with devotees, so we don't notice it so much. But you go outside, and then, you know, if you live outside with karmis for a month and you come back here, then, you know, you notice that there's quite a difference in the facial features of the people that live in the ashram, you know. So that's at least a part of the Prarabdha Karma, you know, the facial features and the person's gait, and you know, so many physical things about the person's form can also change. So bhakti, this bhakti is pavitra, purifying. And pradyaksha avagamam dharmyam, that it is directly perceived by the participant. Right? This is pradyaksha dharma. Pradyaksha is generally, we except this means like sense perception or ocular perception, that which you see with your eyes. Aksha means eyes, right? So pratyaksha means that which is seen with your eyes, under your eyes. So the devotee, it's not that he just waits until he dies and then he understands the highest truth, like it is said, Pantanjali kahe Ishvara hoy swarup gyan, that when you, after you come to realize the Supreme Absolute Truth at that time, then you'll have knowledge of His form like this. But the devotee, he gets immediately some degree of realization in his practice. It's not that he has to come to the highest point of samadhi and have darshan, direct sakshat darshan with God before he gets any realizations. He gets realizations right from the beginning of his practice of bhakti. That's why a new bhakta, he knows more about God than, you know, any other kind of yogi, even though the other yogi may be practicing for 20, 30 years, he may be quite proficient. But someone who's just beginning the process of bhakti, he gets realization, because Krishna gives that to him when he sees that that person is surrendering and that his goal is to come to develop love for Krishna. So this practice of ananya bhakti is pratyaksha dharma, and there's direct perception. Of course, there's what's called vaidushya pratyaksha. That's when there's actual mystical cognizance of the Supreme. In other words, when you have when you come to a high level of bhakti, like bhava bhakti, then you can directly see God with your spiritual senses, right? Atindriya, it's called, super senses. Because the soul originally has spiritual senses, right? We have a spiritual form, and it has, you know, eyes, nose, hands, ears. So those are, means it is the, Prabhupada writes, the perfection of religion, because it is the goal of all religious practices. And it is not that this practice, this path of bhakti is adharmic. It's not that it is against religious principles, but rather, by performing bhakti, one automatically attains perfection in all of the occupational duties of varna and ashram, simply by performing bhakti. Like there's the famous verse by Narada, yata taror mula nishechanena. Right? So when one waters the root of the tree, then all of the leaves and branches are automatically satisfied. So when one performs bhakti to Bhagavan, then automatically all the demigods, right, are satisfied. And we have another verse, devarshi bhutapti nirnam pritranam natkinkano nayam rinicharajan. When one does bhakti, then automatically also the devas and the rishis and the living entities and the parents, and right, the sons and daughters, automatically one is free from all social debts or dharmic debts to them when he surrenders to Mukunda. So dharma. Then susukam. That it is not only sukham, but it's susukham. And it's very joyfully performed. Because one doesn't have to undergo the suffering that found in the, you know, jnana path, the yoga path. It's so difficult to sit and control the senses and control the mind. It's almost impossible. It's great suffering. And so many austerities, and so much fasting, and this and that. Living in the mountain caves, it's very cold. Right. So all we do is chant and dance. We just sing, dance, and feast. That's our process. Lord Chaitanya is just dancing and singing all night. Then he goes home and takes rest. In the morning, does a little puja, goes to the Ganga, takes his meal, worships Vishnu, right? Then in the evening again, they just have kirtan all night. And they take a bath in the Ganga. It's just, that's the process. So, susukum kartum. And there's not so much physical or mental misery on the path of bhakti. And avyayam. The word vidya is being described by the adjective avyayam. That this path is everlasting. It's indestructible. So there's no path which is so indestructible as bhakti. That's the only eternal path. So whatever you do on this path, you do in the spiritual world with Krishna eternally. So the Navavida Bhakti, all of these processes of hearing, chanting, praying, serving Krishna in so many different ways, making garlands for Krishna, decorating his kunja, you know, the altar, you know, cooking for him, dressing him, bathing him. That's going on in the spiritual world. These things are eternal. There's no other path like that. You don't see the gopis, you know, doing Ashtanga yoga, or reading the Upanishads, or something like this. They're doing the things that we do in the temple, that's what they do. So it's avyayam. Going back to Pratyaksha Dharma, it's also mentioned that there's a famous verse, Bhakti Pareshana Bhavo Vairaktir Anyatra Chayasha Chuka Eka Kala Prapanyamanyasya Yatashna Tusyus Tushti Pushti Kshudapayo Nagasam. So this Bhagavatam verse describes that just as when someone eats, automatically he gets satisfaction, nourishment, and eradication from his hunger. So similarly, when one does practices bhakti yoga, he automatically, at one time, gets devotion or love for God, some realization, direct realization, para isha anubhava, and virakti, he gets detachment by performing this process. And I think it is Sridhar Swami, he made a comment of this Bhagavatam verse that bhakti and tushti are the same because they both take the form of pleasure. That there's some love, and then there's, when you're eating, there's satisfaction in taking the food. And he said that pareshanubhava, or realization, is the same as pushti because they both sustain one's life. One gets nourishment from eating food, and one gets realization of God directly. So that sustains the lives of the devotees. And similarly, virakti is the same as shuddhapayo. When you eat, your eradication of your hunger is satisfied. So also your hankering, you know, for material sense objects is also abated immediately to the degree that you perform your bhajan. So that both of those free one from hankering and allows one to be peaceful. So the Sridhar Swami has commented on these words. The process of eating and the process of bhakti is similar in those ways. So, this process gives one taste and some experience. Gives one rasa, taste. So he can be peaceful and not hanker for the sense objects. Maybe we can let's open the doors here in the back too. Get a little air. Prabhupada gives the example of Narada Rishi in his commentary, which is quite long in this verse. He's describing this pratyaksha, that it is a person becomes enlightened with knowledge, without a doubt. And he quotes the Vedanta Sutra, Prakashascha Karmana Bhyasat. Devotional service is very potent. Just by doing this, one gets revelation. And we see that Narada, he was just a little boy. He wasn't studying the Vedas. You know, he didn't know Sanskrit. He was the son of a Shudrani. And all he did was hear the Bhaktivedantas, some babas who came to the ashram, you know, they're chanting bhajan and perhaps having some classes. He's listening, and he took the remnants of their food. And just from that, in 6 months or whatever, he got direct, you know, realization of God. He heard the voice of the Supreme Lord. And the Lord said, I regret that in this lifetime you will not see me again, because those who are not completely perfect in their bhakti cannot see me. Right? So Narada heard the voice of the Lord, right, in his meditation. But he didn't, you know, he wasn't like a big preacher. He wasn't a big scholar. He didn't sacrifice, you know, all of his wealth to the Lord. He wasn't doing anything. All he did was hear these devotees chanting and singing. And he took their prasadam. That's it. And automatically everything was revealed to him. So Prabhupada said, this is called pratyaksha, directly perceived. So Prabhupada describes all of these points also in his commentary in different ways. Even in describing Dharma, he mentions Narada in this example too. That Narada was just the son of a maidservant. He had no opportunity to go to school. He was just assisting his mother. So the highest goal of religion was achieved by him just by the simple process of bhakti. Prabhupada also described Susukam. Why is it so happy? Because devotional service consists of hearing and chanting. So one can just hear and chant about the Lord or attend some lectures. Just by sitting, right, one can learn. And then take the remnants of food. Yeah, it's very simple. Yes. Oh, 1 second. Let me just finish this verse now. Baladeva Nibhushan says, this Dharma is so joyfully performed, one may wonder, who would remain in samsara? Who's so foolish? You know. Prabhupada also quotes that it is said here that this devotional service is eternally existing, avyayam. It is not as the Mayavadi philosophers claim. Although they sometimes take to so-called devotional service, their idea is that as long as they are not liberated, they will continue their bhakti. But at the end, when they are liberated, they will become one with God and they reject bhakti. Such temporary time-serving bhakti is not accepted as pure devotional service. Because actual devotional service continues even after liberation. And Prabhupada adds, as will be seen in Bhagavad Gita, actual devotional service begins after liberation. So he crushes the Mayavadi idea of using bhakti just to get liberation and then kicking away the process and the guru along with that process too. Which I know you are familiar with this example. Then at the end, Prabhupada writes that by these yogic methods, one may make a little progress toward bhakti yoga, but without coming to the stage of devotional service, one cannot understand what is the personality of Godhead. Okay. You have a question about this verse? Yeah, that's in chapter 6. Yeah. That's the general procedure. It takes a long time. Yeah. And there's other examples are just to show the potency of the process. And that type of thing doesn't happen to all devotees at all times. But it happened with Narada and Dhruva, and they were special cases, and they were given that special ability to come to very quickly. Of course, Narada is Nitya Siddha, and Prabhupada writes, and Sadhan Siddha simultaneously. So his coming to bhakti is to exemplify the potency of bhakti. And with Dhruva, it's a similar process because Dhruva was initiated by Narada. And he was also the son of a great king and not an ordinary person. And surely we could say that the Lord has given him such a quick result to glorify the process of bhakti in the Bhagavatam too. So these are special cases. But generally, the usual procedure is that acharyana takes a long time, hearing and chanting. Generally, it's Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes that it takes 3 births to attain perfection. 1 birth as a Kanishna, 1 as a Madhyam Adhikari, and 1 as Uttam Adhikari. That's the general procedure or scenario. Now, Prabhupada kind of, encouraged us to finish everything in one lifetime. And it's possible. to do that. Especially, Prabhupada, it seems that he made like a special deal with the Lord. You know, these people are so fallen, they can't really do anything. And if they follow these basic things for one lifetime, you'll bring them back. Yeah, okay. You know, and then Prabhupada said, you know, you can do it in one lifetime. It's like this. So if we're, you know, if we're very determined, we can do that. And that's very quick, one lifetime. That, I mean, basically one lifetime means like 50, 60 years for us now, right? You start when you're 20, and then you're not going to live much past, you know, 80. So it's like 60 years at most. It's a short time. So now, the text 3 of this last verse of this first section. Arjuna may ask that if this dharma is so easily performed, then why do people remain in material existence? Right? If it's so joyfully performed, if it's so easy and so wonderful. So then Krishna answers in text 3. Ashaddadhana purusha dharmasyasya padantapa aprapya mamni vartante mrityu samsara vatmani. Those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me, O conqueror of enemies. Therefore, they return to the path of birth and death in this material world. So, ashadadana means those people who lack faith in this practice of bhakti. Prabhupada writes, the faithless cannot accomplish this process of devotional service. That is the purport here. Faith is created by association with devotees. Unfortunate people, even after hearing all the evidence of Vedic literature from great persons, still have no faith in God. So they think that these glorifications are just false eulogy or exaggerations. That's called artavad. Right? A person who thinks these exaggerations of the holy name or the process of bhakti are just false, then when you see his face, you should just jump in the holy river with all your clothes on. That is how bad it is, because it means the person has no faith. Now, Prabhupada says, now the development of that faith is the process of Krishna consciousness. There are three divisions of men. The third class are those who have no faith. Even they are officially engaged in bhakti, they cannot achieve the highest perfection. Most probably they will slip after some time. Right? The Kanishthas. They may become engaged, but because they haven't complete conviction and faith, it's difficult for them to continue. We have practical experience in ISKCON. Some people come and apply themselves with some hidden motive. And as soon as they are economically a little well situated, they give up this process and take to their old ways again. It's only by faith that one can advance in Krishna consciousness. As far as the development of faith is concerned, one who is well versed in the literatures of bhakti and has attained the stage of firm faith is called a first class person in Krishna consciousness. And in the second class are those who are not very advanced in understanding the bhakti shastras, but who have automatically have firm faith that Krishna bhakti is the best course, and in so good faith they have taken it up. Thus they are superior to the third class, who have neither perfect knowledge of the scriptures nor good faith, but by association and simplicity are trying to follow. The third class person in Krishna consciousness may fall down, but when one is in the second class, he does not fall down. And for the first class person, there is no chance of falling down. Interesting commentary, huh? One in the first class will surely make progress and achieve the result at the end. As far as the third class person is concerned, although he has faith in the conviction that bhakti to Krishna is very good, he has not yet gained adequate knowledge of Krishna through the scriptures like Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Sometimes these third class persons have some tendency towards karma yoga and jnana yoga, and sometimes they are disturbed. But as soon as the infection of karma and jnana are vanquished, they become second or first class persons in Krishna consciousness. Faith in Krishna is also divided into three stages and described in Srimad Bhagavatam. First class, second class, and third class attachment are also described in the 11th canto. Those who have no faith even after hearing about Krishna and the excellence of devotional service, who think that it is simply eulogy, find the path very difficult, even if they are supposedly engaged in bhakti. For them, there is very little hope of gaining perfection. Thus, faith is very important in the discharge of devotional service. So faith is very important. We get faith from associating with devotees that have faith, and by endeavoring on the path and getting some result. Because when we get some result, when we endeavor, then that gives us faith that this works. So then we endeavor more and get some more results. Some freedom from suffering, some freedom from material hankerings and sin, some peaceful, the mind becomes peaceful, some taste for chanting and taste for hearing. This gives us faith. So here this word dharma, dharmasya, asya, means dharma in the form of bhakti. So this the word dharma in this verse means only bhakti. Dharmasyasya parantapa. Those who are not faithful in this dharma of bhakti, they cannot come to me. Aprapya mam. They can't get me. But nivartante mrityu samsara. They just return to the path, birth and death. Well, maybe they're not so seriously hearing or attentively hearing. Or there could be some other problems. Maybe they're not as sincere. Or they could be very weak, sensually weak. Well, I found that in my experience that persons that just don't have that much faith, they're not so eager to come to the classes. They're not so eager to hear. They take some of the extraneous parts of, our practice, the accoutrements. Huh? They're not so much absorbed in the internal aspects, but the external aspects of ISKCON, They get some service, and they get some money, and they make some friends, and they find a place that they can, socialize and, find a, wife or husband and make some money and get a green card, maybe, or so many different external things, Or they just like to take, delicious food. they like. They come to our restaurants. You can get absorbed a lot in the external or kind of subsidiary things, astrology, yoga, different kind of mystical things. Like I know one guy that was coming to our London temple for years, and then he got into Reiki, and then that for him that was like the culmination, the goal of his practice of mystic yoga. He became a Reiki guru, and he started thinking that he ended up kind of, taking Diksha outside from some yogi or something, and he used to sit in some of the classes, but he was taking it, the whole thing, in a different way. His goal wasn't to just love and surrender to Krishna. It was to learn of some of the mystic Vedic sciences and about Sanskrit and about yoga and mind control and elevation and, cosmology, higher planets. And, this all is kind of thing that has nothing really directly with bhakti, but it's kind of included within our process, right? And there are some people that can go on for years like that, And then they never quite get on the right in the path to, you know, to, they never quite catch the point where they can love Krishna and want to serve Krishna. You know, I've seen like this people many times. So that, you know, it's like partly their desire, partly their level. You know, it has a lot to do with so many different factors there. We can't just say that, okay, he's going to sit down in the class and he's going to have faith. It's not that, it's not mechanical. It's like hearing with a desire. It's like you have your own desire. Everybody has their own desire. When they're hearing in a different way. You know, the same thing, and everyone's hearing it differently according to what they want. Everybody likes to hear what they want. It's like Krishna, when he went into Kamsa's wrestling arena, everyone saw him in a different way. It's the same thing. So there's no like guarantee just because the sound's going in your ear. That's why the art of hearing is not just a mechanical thing. You have to cultivate that. Okay, let's go on to the next section. From 4 to 11, or 4 to 10. Right. So the first section is called Hearing About Krishna, Qualifications and Disqualifications. What are the qualifications? Well, the simple, you know, or the general prerequisite is that a person is simple. And then in 9.1, we see the word anusuya, but he has to be non-envious. And in 9.2, rajavijja means the person also is like open-hearted or generous. He's like a royal person. He's not a kripana, a miserly person, just selfishly getting something for himself. Willing to dedicate himself to others, helping others. He's generous, generous heart. And in text 3, we see that this faithfulness and loyalty is also a prerequisite. So these are the qualifications for hearing given in these three verses. Simple, non-envious, generous, and faithful, or loyal. Prabhupada tells the story of this man who had a dog. I wrote this in my book. Maybe you read this. So and he had a baby daughter, I believe. So he went to the shop. He went out to go shopping in the market. So he left his baby on the bed, and he kind of told his dog, you know, you stay here and protect the baby. So, and then he left. So when he came back, he was shocked because the baby was gone, and he saw a trail of blood going out the back door into the yard. So he ran, he rushed out there, and he was looking. And then he saw his dog coming out from the bushes with blood all over its mouth. And he thought, oh my God, the dog killed my child. Ah. And he just ran back into the room and got his revolver. And then he ran back to the yard and he pointed at his dog. His dog was just looking at him, you know, didn't move, didn't try to escape. And boom, he just shot the dog, fell over dead. And as soon as he shot the revolver, the sound, the child was inside under the bed, and she started crying. So he thought, and then he was confused. What happened? I thought the child was dead, and now he went inside and he saw the baby was under the bed. Then he was confused, and he ran back out to the yard, and he went to the place where the dog was coming out from the bushes. He went further, and he found like a fox there or some, you know, jackal. So that it was killed. It was dead, covered with blood. So then he realized that his dog had very faithfully protected his baby, and then fought with the jackal, and then killed it, and then dragged it out into the bushes, out into the backyard. So when he came in, he saw the dog like this, so he felt very bad that he'd killed his dog, and that his dog was very faithful to him, and didn't even try to run away when he shot him. So Prabhupada said, a dog is a very low-class animal. But it has one good qualification. He's loyal and faithful to his master. So having faith, if a dog can have faith in its master, then if we can't have, that means we're lower than a dog. Right? So we should take the example and from the simple animal. Actually, all the animals can act as our gurus, and because they all have some quality which we can imbibe. So faithfulness and loyalty to one's guru, to one's sampradaya, to one's adiguru, the founder acharya, like this. This is to one's path of bhakti. This is important. So from 4 to 10, here now we have Krishna's inconceivable relationship with the material world. So this is describing achintya bheda bheda tattva. So Krishna now immediately begins speaking so that Arjuna can start to hear this guhyatamam, which one's faith and devotion increases. So this Aishvarya Gyan is needed for Dasya Bhakti and is given in these seven verses from 4 to 10. Aishvarya Gyan? Huh? Yeah, it's all considered Aishvarya Gyan. There's seven verses. Text 4. Maya tatamidam sarvam jagad avyakta murtina matstani sarva bhutani na chaham te savastitaha. By me, in my unmanifest form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. Prabhupada writes that, thus for people in general, he is not visible, that he's unmanifest. Only one who is engaged in pure devotional service, he's revealed. So Baladeva Nibhushan writes, Krishna's opulences are a catalyst for devotion. We'll discuss. So here, unmanifest means impalpable. Or difficult to grasp. So the Lord is the cause of the prakriti, and the cause is always present in the effect. Thus, the Lord is all pervading in the world. Huh? The Lord is the cause, and the material is the effect. And the cause is always present in the effect. So in this way, the Lord is all-pervading in this world. But he says, but I am not in them. Why? Because Krishna doesn't associate with the material energy. Krishna is free or independent of the prakriti, but the prakriti is not independent of Krishna. So it's in him, meaning it's like dependent on him. But Krishna is independent. He's not dependent on the prakriti. He's okay. So all beings are in Krishna in that they are dependent on him. But he is not dependent on them. Prabhupada writes, yet one should not conclude that because he is spread all over, he has lost his personal existence. To refute such an argument, the Lord says, I am everywhere, and everything is in me, but still I am aloof. Prabhupada gives the example of the king who heads a government, in which there's, which is only the manifestation of the king's energy. The different governmental departments cannot run without the king. So the king is, in one sense, present in all the departments. But at the same time, he doesn't have to personally go there and stick his nose in, you know, everyone's papers, right, and see what's going on. He can remain aloof, but at the same time, he's present there. Prabhupada says, one can expect the king to be present in every department personally. And Prabhupada also has given the example of a director of like a drama company. Like he trains all of the actors what to say, how to say, how to move, where to stand, how loud. And he trains them and he trains them and they rehearse and they rehearse. And then on opening night, the curtain opens. And, you know, the director could be out, you know, enjoying, you know, playing golf or something. He may not be actually there, but the whole thing's going on under his direction. So he's actually present in the drama because he directed everything that's going on in the drama. But he may be, you know, out getting drunk or whatever. Right? But he's present, you know, on the stage with the actors, because his energy was the thing which created the whole thing. And Prabhupada also gives the example of the cassette tape. Like he said that I am present in my lectures. You listen to the sound, that's me. But at the same time, I'm not actually physically present. He writes at the end of the commentary, the creation takes place by the diffusion of his different energies. And, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Vashtabhyaham idam kritsnam, he is everywhere present by his personal representation, the diffusion of his different energies. So that's called Shakti Parinamvad, or the philosophy of, I can say, transformation of energies. Because the material world is not a transformation of Krishna himself, but is a transformation of his energies. There's Maya Shakti, Tatashta Shakti, and then in the spiritual world there's Chit Shakti. So by these energies he expands himself. But those energies are none different from himself. So in that way he's present in the material world, spread everywhere. But at the same time, he doesn't lose his personal existence. And all the living entities and all the material nature is in him, because it's all resting on him or dependent on him. Prabhupada gave a lecture in 1966 in New York. He said, electric power is everywhere, within the wiring, and the electrician can use it. Similarly, Krishna's energy is everywhere. When we become like the electrician, we can become transcendentally situated. We can see God anywhere. It is possible by service and love. When Krishna's devotee is there, he can manifest himself anywhere. Krishna can manifest himself anywhere. But when there is no devotee, then he is not there, although his energy is there. And he gives the example of Prahlad Maharaj. He saw Nrisimhadev in the pillar, but his father did not see. It requires qualification. So if we have developed love for God, we can see him everywhere. Text number 5. Nachamatstani bhutani pasyame yogam aishvaryam bhuta-brinna-ca-bhuta-sto-ma-matpa-bhuta-bhavanaha. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation. For myself is the very source of creation. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur quotes as Krishna in his commentary, although all beings and the elements are situated in me, they're not in my sarup, because I am asanga, aloof. So Arjuna says, if you say, Arjuna says, you've contradicted your previous statement. He said, all beings are in you, and now you say that they're not in you. So Krishna says, my response to that is, just see my mystic opulence. This is my expertise, Arjuna, which makes the impossible possible. So this is Krishna's achintya shakti. That's what makes him God. That he's Everything's resting in him and everything's not resting in him. Prabhupada said, so the Lord said everything's resting in him. That should not be misunderstood. The Lord is not directly concerned with the maintenance and sustenance of the material manifestation, like Atlas holding up the globe. So they're all all of these material things, the whole cosmic creation is just floating in Krishna's energy. In this way, they're resting in Krishna. But not they're not like stuck all in his swarup. but at the same time, you know, if Krishna wants, he can show, you know, that everything's inside of him to his mother when he opens his mouth. But it's not that, you know, he's, you know, struggling, you know, walking around. Because, I mean, gee, I got all these universes inside of me, you know, it's really hard for me to get around. It just like automatically just happening. So then, because it's a little inconceivable, therefore Krishna now gives an example to try to make it understood to Arjuna. Yatha kashastito nityam vayu sarvatra gomahan tatha sarvani bhutani matstani yutu badharaya. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. So this gives some understanding, because the sky is always in the background, and it is like the resting place, or the, you know, the background of everything is space, or the sky, ether, right? And the wind is blowing everywhere, and it's always resting in that sky. Although it seems independent, it blows here, it blows there, east, west, north, and south. But it's no matter where it blows, it's always resting in the sky, because the sky is behind it, kind of subtly, right? So similarly, everything in this material world is moving and growing and transforming, but Krishna's always in the background. Therefore, everything's resting in Krishna. And even though he's maintaining everything, he's aloof. So Arjuna says that, you said that your potency is inconceivable, but now you've just given me an example by which I can conceive of it. So how is it inconceivable if you've given me a conceivable example? So then the Krishna's answer is that the example I gave you, Arjuna, is of inert articles, like the wind and the sky is inert, but I and the living beings are conscious. So when conscious being maintains something, creates and maintains something, then he's always attached to that thing. If he's not, then it's very unusual. Then it's inconceivable. So, but I'm the only person who can do that. I can create and maintain and something and become totally aloof from it at the same time. I said, ordinary living beings can't do that, Arjuna. That's why I say the example is inconceivable, that this ability is inconceivable. Even though I've given you an example. I've given this example just so that common people can get a grasp of what I'm trying to say. Since they can get the Siddhanta. I'll give you another example. Rahu's head. It's just like it's Rahu, but it's not Rahu. Because it's only his head. So similarly, everything is in me, and at the same time, it's not in me. So Vishwanath Chakravarti says, this is Krishna's achintya shakti, his inconceivable potency, and we can only fold our hands and offer respect to his greatness. And in this verse, Prabhupada writes the very famous statement that not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Supreme Lord, right? But that doesn't mean that Krishna's up there counting all the blades of grass. Oh, okay, that one moved. Okay, now let that one move. Now this one should move also. Right? Okay. So now Arjuna says, all right, now we've understood that all beings are in you. But what happens to them, or where do they go during the Mahapralaya, during the great destruction? So Krishna answers this question in text 7. Sarva bhutani kunteya prakritim yanti mamikam kalpakshaye punastani kalpado visrajamyaham. O son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature, and at the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I create them again. So Prabhupada writes that the end of the millennium means at the death of Brahma. So we're not talking about the partial annihilation here, but the Maha Pralaya, Kalpa Kshaye, the destruction of at the end of Brahma's life. So Krishna says that the living entities, they enter into me, into my nature, and then I create them again.